Good morning, Robert Clary for the appellants in both of these consolidated appeals. I wanted to begin by just sort of outlining the three main issues that I see in the case, which number one would be the Article III constitutional question, whether or not there's constitutional jurisdiction. Second would be, with respect to the Southern District appeal, whether there's statutory jurisdiction under 28 U.S.C. 1963 for a bankruptcy court to preside over the enforcement of a registered money judgment. And the third issue is the variety of contempt questions that arise out of the proceedings in the Southern District, specifically the scope of a bankruptcy court's authority to order the imposition of contempt sanctions against exempt property. Now, I want to begin with the Article III issue because that's the what the court asked us to consider in its question, and specifically whether or not this is a collateral attack on a judgment that has been rendered final by the bankruptcy court. And the specific case in question that the court asked us to look at was the Travelers against Bailey case that I cited in my reply brief. I don't think there is a collateral attack here. And I say that because I believe Stern says that bankruptcy courts do not have the authority to enter a final judgment on Article III issues. If you agree with me that these are Article III issues, then the judgment of the bankruptcy court here was never final. And because of that, because the entire Chico line of cases and that culminate in Travelers versus Bailey depends on the concept of res judicata. If there's no final judgment, there can't be any res judicata. And I think what's happening here is we had an Article I tribunal adjudicate claims that are reserved to the judiciary, Article III courts. And that the question is whether you can give res judicata effect to the purported judgment of that court to basically bind later on an Article III court from declaring it unconstitutional?
Well, the answer is Travelers versus Bailey, and I think the answer is clearly yes, because it doesn't matter what the source of the lack of authority is. It could be lack of diversity jurisdiction. It could be, lack of personal jurisdiction. But when if it has been litigated to a final judgment, Bailey says you can't reopen it. I mean, I think the procedural posture of that was very similar to this case.
Well, Your Honor, the way I look at Stern.
I don't look. This is not Stern. This is a matter of you moved under 60B4, which is exactly what they moved under in Travelers, I believe, alleging that the bankruptcy court originally had no jurisdiction to give the release of non-parties or whatever it was.
Well, but remember in Travelers what they were dealing with was an injunction that had been incorporated as part of the order confirming the plan of reorganization, clearly right in the wheelhouse of bankruptcy court jurisdiction. That's not the case here. We have here an Article I tribunal that purported to adjudicate Article III claims. And I do think Stern is relevant because Stern was really a race between two judgments. And ultimately, what the Supreme Court held was it affirmed the Ninth Circuit and said you have to give preclusive effect to the Texas judgment because there is no judgment of the bankruptcy court.
But that all came up on direct appeal.
Yes, that's true. But that shouldn't change the fact if there's no final judgment, there's no direct appeal.
Well, if you had appealed to the Supreme Court on the basis on which Anna Nicole did or Marshall did, what his estate did later on, maybe you would have preserved that issue, but you didn't.
Well,
one of the few stones left unturned by Mr. Kornman, perhaps.
Yeah. I'm not here, and I want to make that clear. I'm not defending a lot of his antics below. My arguments are based solely on legal contentions. But I do think that an Article I court cannot adjudicate to final judgment an Article III issue. And if that's true, cannot enter a final judgment adjudicating that.
Well, the Article III issues you're referring to are what, fraudulent transfer?
Fraudulent transfer and preference. Now, they're,
right.
I think...
Isn't that one of the cornerstones of bankruptcy to prevent that sort of activity?
Yes, there are certainly statutes in the Bankruptcy Code, 544, 548, 547. All of those statutes deal with preferences, fraudulent transfers. There's no question about that. But I don't think that that's dispositive of the question of whether Stern applies. In fact, Texas General Petroleum, the case I cited in my reply brief, says basically that Article III does apply to fraudulent transfer.
And in the bankruptcy proceeding, original bankruptcy proceeding in the Northern District of Texas, as I understand it, no objection was made on a jurisdictional basis to the fraudulent transfers, et cetera, because it was an agreed-upon liquidation.
Well, Your Honor, I think certainly no objection was raised to jurisdiction
right.
At the adversary proceeding.
And then the direct appeal to the district court failed for failure to prosecute or something.
That's correct.
Never even presented to the district court.
That's correct. But the question is, could you even appeal to the district court? Did you have a final judgment to appeal?
Well,
that's
the
issue.
If you had a piece of paper.
Had that been timely raised, it could have easily been solved by the district court either saying the bankruptcy court has jurisdiction affirmed, or if there's a question about this, I accept the bankruptcy decision as a report and recommendation and you know, I entered the same judgment.
Well, the district court here said that he treated the findings and conclusions of Judge Hauser as proposed findings and conclusions. But I don't think there's any statutory authority anywhere for a bankruptcy court to do that in a court proceeding. It just doesn't exist. Congress can do that. Congress can cure this whole thing.
Well, you're still talking post-Stern.
I'm talking post-Stern. But Congress can pass legislation that's applicable to any judgment that has not yet been rendered final. And then the courts would apply that statute.
Do you know any court that has accepted this kind of argument for reopening 3 or 4 year old judgments post Stern?
I don't think that any court has addressed this precise issue. I think this is the first court that's been presented to. But I do think that it's correct. And I think I don't think it creates a massive problem for the courts. I'll say that. I know that the court's going to be concerned with the practical consequences.
Well, there have been courts issuing judgments in fraudulent transfer and preference cases for quite some time, and bankruptcy courts, that is, thinking they had core jurisdiction. And, you know, this would certainly be totally contrary to the finality idea in Travelers versus Bailey.
It would be, except that in Travelers versus Bailey, at least the bankruptcy court that entered the final judgment was in at least the way I read the case, was exercising Article I jurisdiction when it entered its orders. It may have exceeded its authority, but at least it was exercising Article I jurisdiction. Here, the bankruptcy court was exercising Article III jurisdiction, which it cannot do. So I'm going to move on to the 1963 issue. In the Southern District. There, we're dealing with statutory authority. And my reading of that statute is that you cannot register a money judgment in another district and have it enforced by the bankruptcy court. In fact, even judgments of bankruptcy courts, if they're registered in a foreign district, are enforced by the district court.
Well, now you're talking about enforcement or registration, and I don't want you to waste all your time on this issue, but, I mean, as far as registration, 1963, you're not going to argue that the unified clerk in Houston could not register this judgment.
Well, I made that argument, that they had registered it in the bankruptcy court, but my primary argument is that the bankruptcy court under 1963 cannot enforce a registered judgment. And the reason I say that is because I think the statute is pretty clear that 1963 funnels the judgments of all federal courts in the registration context Once you have a final judgment and it's registered in the district, it becomes a judgment of the district court in the district where registered. And I believe the language is, and it is enforced in like manner.
And the reference has nothing to do with that?
I don't think it does.
Your best case for that. But again, I don't want you to spend all your time on this issue.
Your Honor, I think this court in a couple of cases, and I'm trying to, you know, I don't remember them right now, but there are two primary cases under 1963 where the court has held that the judgments, once properly registered, money judgments under 1963, become the judgments of the district court in the district of registration. And I just think that it's not really a bankruptcy matter once it's registered, because all we're doing here is registering a judgment of a bankruptcy court awarding monetary damages. The claims that gave rise to those monetary damages have been basically subsumed within the final judgment itself. All you're really doing is saying enforce the judgment. And you enforce the judgment by registering it, making it a new district court judgment in the district of registration. Finally, I wanted to get to the contempt issue. Judge Isker in the Southern District obviously has imposed contempt sanctions, several contempt sanctions against Mr. Kornman. I don't disagree that Mr. Kornman may have acted in a contemptuous manner. I'm not up here asking the court to find otherwise. What I am saying is that there's a limit on the scope of a bankruptcy court's authority to impose the sanctions of the type that have been imposed here. And specifically, I don't think that the bankruptcy court has the authority to impose civil contempt sanctions against exempt assets. And I say that primarily because the bankruptcy rules, Rule 9020, 9014, they incorporate Rule 7069 of the bankruptcy rules. And what they say is that a contempt proceeding is a contested matter. And Rule 7069 says you enforce a monetary award in that type of proceeding in accordance with state rules. And the state rules here, the rules of Texas, would not permit the enforcement of a monetary award against exempt assets. That's my primary argument here.
So does that mean that the bankruptcy rules narrow the permissible scope of enforcement of contempt? Because if you would acknowledge that the district court, as we have clear authority, could levy on it without respect to state law in order to enforce certain policies, you know, important policies. That's that Hodgson case and that SEC case. So the district court needn't follow state law, state exemption law. But you're saying the bankruptcy courts have self-limited by the rules, the scope of their enforcement power?
First of all, I think that those cases that you've mentioned, Your Honor, are cases that are unique in that they're equitable in nature.
Well, so is the contempt. Contempt is more than equitable.
Well, contempt here, I think, certainly this court has held that the contempt authority of a bankruptcy judge is much more limited than a federal district judge. There's no criminal contempt power, for example, in a federal district, in a federal bankruptcy judge. You do have cases that say that the contempt power is derived from 105 of the bankruptcy code, which also is limiting in the sense that the court has also said that 105 cannot be construed to grant equitable rights that don't otherwise exist. And that's somewhat limiting as well. So I don't agree that the bankruptcy court's contempt authority is necessarily coextensive with that of a district court. And I do think that the bankruptcy rules limit what a bankruptcy judge can do by way of imposing monetary contempt sanctions against exempt assets.
Which, if any, of these contempt orders has Has Cornyn purged himself of contempt in regard to any of these orders?
You know, Your Honor, they've taken, I think, all of his, all property in his home. I believe they now have custody of all documents that he had in his possession. He's literally got a mattress in his house. That's what he's got.
Well, he's got he owns about 100 corporations.
He owns a lot of equity. He has equity and trust, et cetera, like that. But right now, he's under a court order to compile a list of everything he's got in all those trusts. I think Mr. Cornyn probably doesn't have anything left at all, based on what I can tell, anyhow.
Are you operating pro bono?
Yes, I am, Your Honor, and I'm really thrilled about that.
Well, you're doing a very good job.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Unless the court has additional questions, I guess I'm done.
Claire, you've saved some time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Bryant, we'll hear from you.
May it please the court.
How can you leave this poor guy with just a mattress?
Your Honor, he's in his million-dollar-plus mansion in University Park, and although he hasn't let me see his current living conditions, I don't believe he just has a mattress. As a matter of fact, it's come out that in the last couple of months, he came up with more than $30,000 from one of his trusts to purchase the Lexus that he drives around, and he's also paid for more than $30,000 for property taxes. That has come out since these cases. I could go on, but all of that is outside the record. He has been held in contempt several times since these contempt sanctions, citations. And
by the Southern District?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is this where all the property is now, or what?
No, that's just where the registration occurred and where Judge Isker has devoted a great deal of time to trying to handle this matter properly in difficult circumstances. Your Honor, I'd like to first correct a factual error or misstatement that is in Cornyn Appellant's final reply brief. That's in case number 13-10471. At page 7 of that reply brief, Cornyn states, quote, "Here it is undisputed that appellants were not claimants in the estate of the Heritage Organization, LLC, and thus that the resolution of this adversary proceeding, namely the one that led to the 2009 federal judgment, had nothing to do with the claims resolution process." Mr. Clary was not involved in the case back during that period, so I'm sure that misstatement is not intentional, but it is a misstatement. In fact, Mr. Cornyn and other appellants were claimants in the Heritage bankruptcy. This is mentioned in one of the opinions from which the appeal is being taken, Judge Hauser's opinion of October 3rd, 2011 at 459, Bankruptcy Reporter 911, the page is 915, in which she notes that in 2008, Mr. Cornyn moved to withdraw his proof of claim at that time. In addition, in Judge Hauser's opinion on the confirmation, which is at 375, Bankruptcy Reporter 230, at footnotes 42 and 74, Judge Hauser details Mr. Cornyn's proof of claim, other appellants' proofs of claim, because they were all objecting to the confirmation of this plan on the basis of their standing as creditors. Note 42 notes that Mr. Cornyn filed a proof of claim in 2004 that he estimated as being in excess of $64 million. So it was quite a large claim. He amended that claim on May 10th, 2007. So in 2004, and at the time that the trustee initiated the adversary proceeding that led to the final judgment, and even more than a year later when the plan was confirmed, Cornyn and other appellants did have proofs of claim on file that they were pursuing. Now, ultimately, I don't think that is a decisive factor in this appeal because this is an impermissible collateral attack 2 years later, after a direct appeal, when Stern came out, an attempt after Stern to attack that 2009 final judgment on the basis of the Supreme Court's decision 2 years later. I don't believe that the Stern attack is valid, but even assuming it were, and even assuming it were about jurisdiction rather than statutory authority, Travelers and many other cases, going back to Chico County Drainage District, would say, even if it's on jurisdiction, no matter what, you can't collaterally attack. Now, Travelers does recognize that there are a couple of exceptions to that principle, and the Supreme Court's cases really recognize two types. One is sovereign immunity, which obviously is not at issue in this case, and the second is a category that is described in the restatement as an instance in which a judgment substantially infringes the authority of another tribunal or agency of government. And the only instances in which the Supreme Court has held that applies, or which I've been able to find, are instances which it describes as very rare, where Congress has specifically allocated a type of question to a particular court, and then typically in the Supreme Court cases, a state court goes ahead and enters a judgment in that area of exclusive jurisdiction. The court has held in those instances that can be collaterally attacked. The main one is a case cited by the Cornman appellants, Call versus Firestein, in which back in the Depression, Congress specifically said, if you're going to foreclose on a mortgage of a farmer who's in bankruptcy, the bankruptcy court alone can control that. A state court ignored it, foreclosed. The Supreme Court held that state court judgment was subject to collateral attack. That is not this kind of situation here. To the contrary, in Section 157, Congress said that this was a core proceeding that bankruptcy judges could determine. Now, I understand that there is a lot of argument, and there will be probably for a long time, about exactly how far Stern goes and what it means, but certainly Congress allocated the decision of fraudulent transfer and preference cases to the bankruptcy courts, and it's certainly not some wild improper action by a bankruptcy court to enter that judgment. Therefore, that 2009 final judgment was not subject to collateral attack. Now, I understand appellant's argument now is, well, it really wasn't a final judgment because Judge Hauser didn't have authority to make a final judgment. Well, she has determined that in her view it was a final judgment. Cornman appealed it by saying it was a final judgment. He attacked it on 60B4, which is the way you attack a final judgment. So it is a final judgment. And to me, that argument is like saying, I can't run a red light, therefore if the policeman stops me, the light must not have been red. It was a final judgment and remains so today and not subject to collateral attack.
The old saw, if it quacks like a duck and walks like a duck and so on.
Exactly. This one certainly quacks and walks like a final judgment as far as I can tell. I would also mention the Texas General Petroleum case that counsel cited. In that 1995 decision by the Fifth Circuit, the court said in a liquidating trustee case, a bankruptcy court did have jurisdiction specifically to try and enter a final judgment on a fraudulent transfer claim where it found there had been implied consent from failure to object. Here there was very express consent, but for Cornman's argument to succeed, this court would have to overrule that decision, and as set forth in the Judge Jolly's opinion in Technical Automation Services, court only does that when either en banc, an intervening statute, or when the Supreme Court has explicitly overruled that prior case. Stern does not do that. Stern is very explicit in being a narrow decision that is limited to 157B2C. And the panel opinion in Frazen that we sent letters to the court about in last week.
The argument about the constitutional authority and the authority of the bankruptcy court to enter final judgments. What is your response to the argument that the Article I court does not have that authority?
Your Honor, an Article I judge does have that authority, I believe.
But on what basis do you form that belief?
Right. In the two factors that distinguish this case, in my view, from Stern are, number one, these are federal causes of action created under the bankruptcy law as opposed to state law counterclaims. And here, there was very explicit consent by Kornman and the appellants. They wanted the bankruptcy court to try and enter final judgment because they believed at that time they were going to win. And so they stated in open court to Judge Hauser that they consented, and they filed written consents as well. Now, Stern and other decisions are somewhat unclear, in my view, as to exactly what factors create the lack of constitutional authority. Justice Scalia's concurring opinion points that out. But the court in Stern did make a point of the fact that these were merely state law counterclaims and not matters that needed to be, were based on federal law and needed to be resolved in the course of determining whether and to what extent to allow claims. And the court did make a point of concluding that Marshall had not effectively consented to the trial of Vicki's counterclaim against him. Whether those are the decisive factors or not, I think we'll all see at some point in the future, but I believe they are. Certainly, this court's decision in Texas General Petroleum says, and Judge Hauser was very well aware of it, she had an opinion of the Fifth Circuit saying that if the parties consent, you can try and decide fraudulent preference claims. That's exactly what she did, and in my view, her her judgment should not be subject to collateral attack. Now, with respect to the contempt issue, the 1963 issues, I just want to briefly respond to that. We did not seek out the bankruptcy court in the Southern District of Texas to enforce the judgment. We merely did what the statute tells us to do, which is register that judgment in the district. There is a unified clerk's office in Houston, so we sent it to the clerk, and the clerk, on its own, determined that the proper place under their standing order of reference for this judgment, which, as Judge Isker correctly noted, is essential to this bankruptcy plan, that it involved a bankruptcy matter and therefore should be enforced by the bankruptcy court. Section 1963 does have a reference to the registering court treating it as a judgment of that district. It does not have any explicit provision about who may enforce that within that district. So in our view, it's entirely appropriate for Judge Isker to enforce this bankruptcy court judgment that is essential to a bankruptcy plan in the Northern District. The bankruptcy case in the Northern District is still open. It's not a closed proceeding, and the trustee filed his quarterly report day before yesterday. So this is an ongoing proceeding up there, and this is not only getting a judgment, but enforcing a judgment is an essential part of implementing and executing that plan. Now, with respect to contempt power, for a bankruptcy court, the Fifth Circuit has made it clear that the ultimate source of that is Section 105 of the Code, and it says that bankruptcy judges have power to take steps that are necessary and appropriate to carry out their responsibilities under Title 11. It does not allow criminal contempt. These are not criminal contempts. They're all civil contempts that are intended to either coerce compliance with the court's orders or compensate the trustee for the considerable expense that has been incurred in an effort to bring about compliance with the court's orders. So they're all coercive or compensatory. They're civil. The measure of the court's power under Section 105, and frankly, I think it's essentially similar for a district court that doesn't operate under, is that, as stated in the court's decision in Bradley in 2009, it's practical. The contempt power needs to be sufficient to bring about compliance with the orders, and the precise boundaries have to be found by each trial court under the unique circumstances.
Well, let me just ask you a question. The trustee could have alleviated all these issues about foreclosing on the homestead, which I suspect you could have foreseen, by telling Kornman to give out the names of all of his wholly owned entities and subsidiaries and related companies and so on, and then by systematically foreclosing on the stock of all those. Why didn't the trustee do that?
Your Honor, we have, as the court indicated, hundreds of entities. We have dozens and dozens of trusts, of which Mr. Kornman is trustee and a beneficiary.
Well, that's fine, and you know they're there. So you put him under oath. You ask him questions. When he starts lying to you, you put him in jail.
Well, Your Honor, it may come to that, and in fact, what we did was we made requests that he disclose what was in those corporations, and those are among the orders that he has violated, that he's in contempt for to this day.
I know, but the court can put him in jail for up to a year under civil contempt, can it not?
I believe he can, Your Honor. And when we have deposed Mr. Kornman and asked those questions, he has a remarkable lack of memory. He has an assistant, but she's no longer talking to him,
so,
and she knew all those details. He doesn't know.
You don't think Judge Isker has the guts to put him in jail?
Well, Your Honor, I think the record will show that he's actually come close to that already, and again, the contours of the power are practical. I think that it may well be that
And if he didn't do it, Judge Ellison
will exercise that. But at every point, Mr. Kornman's main defense has not been that he's complying or that he's unable to comply. It is, Your Honor, you don't have any jurisdiction. Every contempt order has been appealed and therefore has been within the appeal process up to this day. I think that decision will be the great step that allows further progress in enforcing this judgment.
And maybe my memory is an error, because maybe the 1 year imprisonment is a criminal contempt sanction. I could be wrong about that. But nevertheless, I mean, you could have gone to Judge Ellison for all of this post-judgment remedy, could you not?
I'm not sure whether we could or not. We have asked Judge Isker on multiple occasions to imprison Mr. Kornman until he complies with various of the orders. In fact, he ordered it at one point in the record and then stayed it pending one of the appeals that is now before this court. So he has indicated his willingness to do that, but I believe that he wanted to be sure that the courts agree that he had jurisdiction before he took that final step. Your Honor, at this point, if the court has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them, but I believe that the judgments of the bankruptcy court, which have been affirmed by Judge Ellison, should also be affirmed by this court. With respect to the homestead issue, I think Judge Jones' comments point to the right answer, which essentially is conflicts between federal court orders, federal policies are not common, but in the rare instance where they occur, the federal interest has to prevail. That's true not only with federal tax liens, where clearly those can be enforced against homesteads despite state statutes that are, of course, intended in Texas only to exempt property from seizure by ordinary creditors. An additional category that this court has upheld are federal forfeitures. People have tried to block federal forfeitures on the basis that it was homestead. And this court in 2007 upheld that forfeiture as against a homestead claim. Here, this defendant has made it clear that he's put all of his assets that could satisfy the contempt sanctions that the court's found in some other name. We're doing the best we can to find out where he's hid them and under what names and then go get them. He's blocking that with his contempt, which has continued since 2011. And under these circumstances, we respectfully submit that it is not an abuse of discretion for Judge Isker to order a sale of the homestead to not to collect a debt for a creditor, but to enforce his orders in service of the policy that federal courts have to be able to make their decrees stick. This is the only way this one can.
Thank you, Mr. Byron.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Clary, you've saved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to say that, you know, the issues here are a lot more important than Gary Kornman. And I think you're going to get, based on the questions, I'm thinking that you're focused on Mr. Kornman, what a bad man Mr. Kornman is, which may or may not be the case. But the truth is that what we're dealing here with is the separation of powers concept. And I don't understand how you can exacerbate the violation of separation of powers that occurred here by giving res judicata effect to a judgment of an Article I body where the claims were subject or Article III claims. If you agree that they're Article III claims, then there should be no res judicata effect given to the bankruptcy court's judgment at all.
Explain to me again why fraudulent transfer and preference under 544 and or 547 and so on are, quote, Article III claims.
Gran Financiera says they are unless they're litigated as part of the claims resolution process. Now, the claims that David was referring to earlier, my understanding is, and I checked the record on this, I think, quite a while ago, is that all those claims are unconditionally withdrawn. There was no litigation involved.
At what point were they withdrawn?
I'm not certain of the date, Your Honor, but it was after the adversary proceeding was filed.
Well, then they were still pending when it was after it was filed. You're saying before judgment was entered?
Before it was pending. They were withdrawn before the trial occurred. I'm not sure exactly when. It was before the trial occurred. It was after the case was filed. But those claims were all, I think there are four appellants that filed proofs of claim that were subsequently unconditionally withdrawn. But at any rate, Gran Financiera, I think, very clearly says, and also Texas General Petroleum, this court's own case says, that you determine whether a claim is an Article III claim by determining whether it should be tried under the Seventh Amendment to a jury. That's what Gran Financiera says. That's what Texas General Petroleum says. And also, Gran Financiera says that preference claims and fraudulent transfer claims are within the scope of Article III, unless they're litigated as part of the claims resolution process. So I really think that you've got a separation of powers concern here that is pretty serious.
So basically, you've got to go back into the entire bankruptcy case in order to determine that it allegedly lacked jurisdiction.
Well, I don't think that that you have to go back to the entire case. What you have to do is figure out whether a claim was filed in the claims register that was disposed of in conjunction with the litigation.
Did you outline that for us in your brief?
My understanding was that none of the claims were alive when the litigation occurred. So what I've said in my brief is what I've advocated here, is that there were no, this was not part of the claims resolution process.
But you didn't have, record citations to the bankruptcy court docket.
I think I did, Your Honor. I cited the, there's nothing to, I cited the specific order that withdrew the four claims unconditionally, but it's there. I'd like to say on the separation of powers concept, before I leave that, I think the court is probably concerned, I think, as you would expect, with the practical consequences of agreeing with me in this case. Are you going to open up Armageddon? Is there going to be a flood of new cases coming down the pike? And the answer is no, because, first of all, for the reasons I've outlined in the brief, I don't think Stern is going to impact all that many cases, actually. Even if it did, Congress can pass a retroactive statute that cures the Stern problem.
Congress can't even pass don't tell us that, Robert.
Well, Your Honor, I understand that frustration. I think every American does today. But
realistically speaking, what you were doing is trying to open up a 4 or 5 year old final judgment on fraudulent transfer where the party specifically consented to the bankruptcy court jurisdiction. And don't tell me there aren't hundreds or thousands of such cases in the 94 districts.
Well, if there are, and if there are people that are willing to litigate this issue, I think what's going to happen is that Congress is going to pass a statute and the case they're going to...
I'll just add that while the Supreme Court has lurched back and forth about the scope of bankruptcy jurisdiction ever since Marathon, it has never opened that big a can of worms.
Well, Your Honor, the only thing, I don't think it's that big of a can of worms, and the reason it's not, in my judgment, is that Plout versus Spendthrift Farms, the Supreme Court's decision in that case, gives Congress the ability to enact a retroactive statute that cures the problem. Thank you. If the Court has any other questions.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Clary, and thank you, Mr. Brock. You've presented arguments that will certainly assist us in resolving this case. That concludes the oral argument. Oral arguments we have for this panel this week. So this panel will stand adjourned.